Thank you, Greg. Well, it's a wonderful feeling to be here to share with you the celebration of a research life well lived. Along with, I guess, Neil, who's already spoken, and Rob Fitzpatrick, who'll be speaking after the break, Rob and I, in particular, had the special enjoyment of being undergraduate students with Malcolm. And I wasn't actually one of his graduate students. My PhD advisor was Johan LaRue, one of his colleagues. But despite that, Malcolm always felt as though he was my graduate advisor, because he was always enthusiastic about what students in his department were doing, whether he was actually supervising them or not. He would often pass a lab and just stick his head around the door and say, "Hey, Martin, what have you proved?" And if you didn't come up with anything, he just walked on. But you know, if you had something interesting to tell him, he'd stay and listen, which was great. And Malcolm, in that fashion, I think inspired me a lot at different stages of my career. I spent a sabbatical with him in Georgia, and he had a pivotal role to play in some of my career moves. So it's great to be here celebrating what I don't believe to be a retirement at all. I hear people talking of him retiring, but I can't believe that that would actually happen. And I thought the best way to celebrate this occasion from my perspective with this new job I've taken in Australia is to share some of the most recent research data that I'm excited about. I've been working on the rehabilitation of red mud, which is the residue from processing bauxite. And the data that I've got are so fresh that I've probably still got some of the red mud stuck under my fingernails. I've been in the lab getting some of these data, and this is by no means a complete study. But there are some really interesting things about it which tie in a lot with some of the things that Malcolm was interested in, gypsum particularly. The reclamation of sodic and alkali soils. This is just a different manifestation of the same set of principles. I guess the research question driving this research is, could we turn the residue from processing bauxite back into soil? I say back into soil because bauxite, this is in the rainforest in South America, is in fact soil to start with. It's in fact an extreme version of an oxisol. In the alumina refinery, the bauxite is digested with caustic soda. So in the process, it produces the residue known as red mud, and this area of about 100 hectare here contains these red mud lakes or ponds, which is an iron oxide rich, has other impurities, material, which is also rich in the caustic alkaline residue from the digestion process. And it needs rehabilitation. The problem with the rehabilitation is that it's extremely alkaline, so much so that we have another version of aluminium toxicity, this time by aluminate. But in fact, the pH of around about 12 to 13 is so high that effectively red mud in its raw form is sterile. And one of the things we're looking at is the idea that without necessarily importing large quantities of soil or organic materials to modify the red mud, in a traditional sort of agronomic way, harnessing principles of plant growth, but also of amending with various simple inorganic materials and fertilizers and so on, we can get the production of organic matter in situ, provided we can neutralize the alkalinity. And one of the things we're exploring is biotitration, which is a sort of biological neutralization. But to be able to achieve that, we've got to achieve some degree of neutralization first. So some of the earlier work that I was involved in consisted of, in fact, doing experiments with bauxite residue, treating it with gypsum, factorial experiments involving various levels of nitrogen and different intensities of leaching, and with cocuyu grass, which Neil was talking about quite a lot earlier. This is a widely used rehabilitation vegetation cover. But this was a pot experiment in the glasshouse, and we made sure that the nitrogen fertilizer treatments had lots of potassium and magnesium topping up during the leachings to make sure that they didn't run out during the experiments. And we got some fantastic results with, this was residue sand which had been modified with the red mud, which had been carbonated. And the most important thing was that initially the leachate from these long pots and these sort of drain pipes came out extremely saline, but within a reasonably small number of pore volumes, say 2 to 3 pore volumes, and this is just days after leaching here, you could get the pH, at least the electrical conductivity, the salinity, down to biologically acceptable levels. Cocuyu grass is unusual in that it's not only extremely tolerant to acidity, as Neil Miles pointed out, but it's quite tolerant of high levels of sodium and salinity as well. And anyway, to cut a long story short here, these early experiments of ours with very high levels of nitrogen and very intense leaching were able, and with the supplementary nutrients that we applied, were able to generate enough cocuyu grass that if you translated this into a biomass production per hectare per year, which of course you can't really do from a pot experiment, but one of my colleagues pointed out that the quantity of biomass that we were getting from this experiment was pretty close to a record for any plant anywhere. In other words, what it meant was that if you treat this bauxite residue gently, it'll reward you with magnificent returns of biomass production. And so this seems to be the direction that needs to be taken with rehabilitation. But before you can get to that kind of plant growth, you need to produce some kind of neutralization, chemical neutralization in situ. And if you neutralize the alkalinity, you need to be aware of the soluble alkalinity in the form of sodium hydroxide and sodium aluminate, and also the fact that it's going to be buffered from solid phases in the form of tricalcium aluminate and sodalite. These are products of the bioprocess of bauxite digestion. And then what you're going to need to do is to use a cheap byproduct, if possible, to conduct the initial neutralization. And one can do this either with, in our case in Western Australia, carbon dioxide from a nearby ammonia plant to one of the refineries, gypsum from phosphoric acid production, again in the vicinity, or bitterns, which is a magnesium-rich brine made from sea salt works, which are available in the region, although not right next door. But again, a waste product that the people producing it are looking for something to do with it. The way that these three kinds of neutralizing agents, which would be potentially cost-effective, would work is as follows. In the case of gypsum, it'll react with the alkalinity, in this case, with this example, with sodium aluminate, in the presence of carbon dioxide, just simply to produce calcium carbonate, thenardite, which is soluble sodium sulfate, and aluminium hydroxide, perhaps gibbsite. A potential product which might form when your carbon dioxide is deficient to begin with is ettringite. And this highly hydrated calcium aluminium hydroxy sulfate mineral is the bane of the cement industry because of its a very important role in destabilizing cement in the presence of high sulfate environments. So a lot is known about ettringite, but very little is known about just to what extent it might form as an initial product when you react red mud with gypsum. In the case of bitterns, which is essentially a magnesium chloride sulfate solution. I presented it here just as magnesium sulfate to make it comparable with the gypsum, but in fact it's probably more chloride than sulfate, reacting with sodium aluminate and with some free sodium hydroxide that might be present as well. It'll form, in this case, a sulfate form of hydrotalcite, which is a well-known layered double hydroxide mineral of magnesium and aluminium, which has a net positive charge, and so it has this interlayer of anions, which, if carbon dioxide is available, carbonate is a preferred anion in that interlayer, and it can displace others through an exchange reaction, and this would be the carbonate form of hydrotalcite. This is an environmentally very important mineral, and as a byproduct of this neutralization process, it itself can impart beneficial properties to the residue, which can help in turning it back into a soil-like material. The carbonation reaction involves reacting the reaction of carbon dioxide with sodium aluminate to form, in this case, the mineral dawsonite. Cancrinite, the one that Nick has just mentioned, would be an alternative, similar or related mineral that could form in this kind of environment. But if this would be essentially an intermediate, if you take the carbonation to completion and you push the pH down well into the bicarbonate region of carbonate equilibria, then gibbsite and sodium bicarbonate would be the sort of end products of this carbonation reaction with the alkalinity. All right, so what I'm going to share with you now is one of the recent experiments that I've conducted in the lab, showing how one can ameliorate this red mud, this alkaline waste, and turn it back into a soil-like material. Just a brief description of the experiment, then I'll show you a couple of photographs illustrating some of the crucial steps. If you take a liter of mud as a 45% suspension, which is about the solids concentration that is currently used by one of the alumina companies in carbonating their red mud. And in this experiment, we carbonated this with carbon dioxide, and by mass, one could determine that about 20 grams of carbon dioxide per liter were used, were effectively combined with the mud. And then, combined with that carbonation, we had either carbonation alone or carbonation including either gypsum or bitterns, 8 grams per liter applied either before or after the carbonation treatment to see which one was more effective. Similarly with bitterns, 70 milliliters of this bitterns, which is a concentrated brine solution per liter, before or after carbonation. And then after these treatments, they were vacuum filtered, and the dewatered material was then re-wet to contain about 60% solids. And this is now the crucial part, and it relates strongly to an attempt to create architecture of the kind that Larry Wilding was talking about. If you add a manganese sulfate catalyst, this is really just to get the next step going, which is the addition of hydrogen peroxide. Then, as many of you will know, your transition metals and manganese is particularly effective, will cause the exothermic decomposition of hydrogen peroxide. And if you use 100 volume, in other words, 30% hydrogen peroxide, you would need only 3 mils of this per liter of your mud suspension to generate 300 mils of oxygen upon decomposition. And I figured that would give about 30% porosity to the final material, roughly. It was sort of a back of an envelope type calculation. Anyway, after peroxide treatment, and you'll see the effects of that just now, it basically produces a structural foam, as it's sometimes called in the engineering literature. And just air drying over a weekend, gently breaking it up and putting it into a column so that it could be leached with water until the leachate salinity was biologically acceptable, less than 2 decisiemens per meter. For the carbonation, some of you would be quite interested to find that the soda stream, which many people use in their kitchens, is a perfect carbonation device. And I acquired one of these from the local Kmart in Perth to use in the lab. And so this is how we carbonated these suspensions of red mud. And after carbonation, and this is days here, you get what's known as a pH rebound, where the initial near-neutral pH from carbonating down into the bicarbonate region starts to work back as the sparingly soluble forms of alkalinity, sodalite, and tricalcium aluminate gradually dissolve and push the pH back up again. And this is where these treatments, besides the carbon dioxide only, which is this middle line here, these other treatments begin to show their mettle, and particularly the Bittern's treatments, but gypsum is starting to do it as well. It starts to buffer the system at about pH 8.5, which is sort of calcite equilibrium, if you like. The magnesium aluminium or layered double hydroxide produced from the Bittern's treatment was buffering the system at a lower pH, although later on there was a bit more rebound, but that just shows the different degrees of buffering by these different treatments and how the before versus after was quite important. And we're still exploring this with some subsequent follow-up factorial experiments in the lab. Anyway, so after those had equilibrated, we then leached, vacuum filtered on a large Buchner, these slurries. Just to show you the filtrate composition, primarily these pH values here are affected by the fact that it was vacuum filtered. If it was pressure filtered, they probably wouldn't have rebounded quite as high as these. But the salinity here, you can see the particularly high salinity from the Bittern's treatments, and that salinity is obviously going to be almost as plant growth limiting as the original alkalinity, unless one can remove it by leaching. And so, but in order to leach red mud, it's got to have architecture. And if it hasn't got architecture in the form that Larry was talking about for water to run through it, then you're stuck, because 10 to the minus 9 meters per second is about the hydraulic conductivity of raw red mud, and you won't get water through there in a big hurry. So this actually shows the hydrogen peroxide being added after the catalyst had been added. And the next slide shows why, instead of red mud, we decided we'd call this bread mud, because in fact, this beautiful bubbly mixture here, and you can see just from the curves around here that this is actually rising like a loaf of bread, and it's actually leavened bread mud. And what's amazing, you put this in a fume cupboard just with a draft over it at room temperature over the weekend, and it dries out into something like this, which is a beautiful cake. And now you can see the macro pore architecture and a little bit of salt efflorescence here. This is probably sodium sulfate. And then the architecture, this is in cross-section, expanded here. So this is about 1 centimeter. And you can see the nature of this macro porosity that's been generated here. And what's really fantastic about this porosity is it appears to be continuous, because Ian Young, a colleague at University of New England, took a fragment of this back after a visit to University of Western Australia, and he established that it in fact has about 30% porosity. This slide here basically is telling us from these fainter values here, those are the continuous pores. This is now with X-ray tomography, where successive very thin slices are effectively photographed through the material. And you can make calculations from the image analysis from those successive slices, which allow you to determine the continuity of the porosity. And this 30% pore space is about 94% continuous. And that means that this basically is behaving almost as if it was just one single pore. So in terms of hydraulic conductivity, that's absolutely fantastic, exactly what one wants. There's some pore size distribution data here, but I won't go into those. We then broke up that dried material and put it into a column and leached it with water, and sure enough, it was in fact remarkably permeable. particularly those treatments that had been received the bitterns. And I think the precipitation of the hydrotalkite has had a great deal to do with the stabilization of that pore space, because that's the other very important thing. You can have continuous pore space, but if your clay is dispersible, and that's something that Malcolm has always emphasized in a lot of the work that he's done, then there's really no value in that pore space at all. You've got to be able to stabilize that architecture, that porosity. And it seems as though the hydrotalkite precipitation is particularly effective at that. I was surprised that the gypsum wasn't as effective as it might have been. And a combination of the two might seem to be a better treatment. Those leaching data showed hydraulic conductivity, at least the removal of salt, and particularly it showed that there was a kinetic effect, because if you left it overnight between leachings, you got a rebound in salinity, and then it washed out again the next day as you started leaching again with these 80 mil increments of water. And that kinetic effect really just shows that the removal of salt in this porous material is more limited by the diffusion through the fine pores into the coarse porosity. What's interesting is if you recalculate those data in terms of the salt that's leached from the ameliorated red mud in kilograms per hectare per 10 centimeter depth versus water applied in millimeters, you're going up to about one winter of rainfall in Western Australia here, and you're going up to about 18 tons of salt leached per hectare, but that's just from 10 centimeters. So you've got a fairly major salt removal problem on your hands if you want to turn this stuff into a soil-like material. But there is at least now an interesting way in which one could readily get rid of that salt after doing the neutralization. The other really interesting thing, and this is one table that I'd really like to share with Malcolm, because it was actually his work on positive and negative charges in oxisols that inspired a lot of my early PhD work on the characteristics of sesquioxidic soils. I was looking for some sign of a point of zero charge. And so just looking at in that leached desalinated material, and this EC column here is just to verify that it was largely desalinated. The Bittens treatment showed the strongest tendency for a convergence of pH measured in water with that in KCl. Still a slight net negative charge, but very close to a net positive charge or a zero point of charge. We know that hydrotalkite, in fact, has that isomorphous substitutional positive charge, and so it has a very high point of zero charge. In fact, it's up at about pH 12 if you can measure it that high. So this hydrotalkite formation from the Bittens would possibly explain why we were getting that stability of the clay fraction and the greatest stability in hydraulic conductivity during leaching. And I suppose the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Here's some annual ryegrass growing in some red mud. This is very small scale in its early days yet, but it does show that you can actually turn a sterile, biologically hostile material into something that can grow perfectly good grass. Just some other interesting angles. These are photographs of the red mud after various treatments, and basically it's the same X-ray diffractogram for all of those treatments. Except on some of them, we were picking up some interesting evaporites like northopite, which is a sodium magnesium carbonate. But what we did was we took this soda stream and we repeated the carbonation, but on the clear leachate or the clear liquor from the mud. In other words, not containing any solids to start with. And this is where it was actually quite interesting, because although this photograph is of some mud suspensions here, the suspensions initially were a clear brown color. And when you carbonate these, they actually turn milky. You get this milky white precipitate of sodium carbonate or dawsonite formed, and it's just like adding milk to your tea. So I thought that was particularly appropriate given the theme of this seminar. And so with these various treatments, you got hydrotalkite formed when you add the Bittens only. You got calcite forming when you add the gypsum only. When you carbonate, you get a poorly crystalline dawsonite here, which is a sodium aluminium carbonate. And subsequent treatment with magnesium or the calcium salt doesn't make any difference. It stays dawsonite. And that's quite an interesting result, which has some bearing on interpreting the final expectations about what's going to happen with all these ideas that we're toying with on carbonation, gypsum, bitterns, nutrient enrichment, hydrogen peroxide, filtration, and washing as a sequence of steps for turning bauxite residue back into a soil-like material. These seven steps, just to summarize in conclusion, are you carbonate, you amend with gypsum, bitterns, ammonium phosphate, and a variety of other essential elements, thicken it, porosify it, dry it, leach it, and once you've leached the salts out, or at least out of the upper part, you can vegetate, and this helps to dry the mud, form cracks and root channels, add organic matter, initiate faunal colonization, and continue carbonation and leaching the natural way. And so, the end of the story, it's certainly not the end of the story yet, but from a gypsum point of view, that explains how it traps carbon, in fact, in two ways, with the kukuyu grass that you saw at the beginning, and then with the formation of calcite and other carbonate minerals. And I'm sure we can think of both of these as Milky Ways. Thank you.